set the table for the Reformation. We looked at the problems of the late medieval church, the problems of the papacy, and then some of the early reformers and early reform movements that the Catholic Church had, and some of the other things like the conciliar movement and different things like that that are going on. Today we're going to begin by looking at Erasmus and humanism in the north, and then we're going to move right into Luther and go from there to Zwingli in the beginning of the Swiss Reform. And then next week we'll look at the rest of the Swiss Reformation. We'll look at Calvin. We'll look at the Anabaptists. And then we'll go from there and look at the Catholic Counter-Reformation up until the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. And that'll pretty much be where Europe sets as far as its Christian lines go. After 1648, not a lot's going to change as far as people, which countries follow which sort of religions or things like that. It's going to be pretty static after that. And then we'll move to England and pick back up with the English Reformation and look at Henry VIII and Cranmer and all those guys. All right, so the first thing I want to start off with, again, is just kind of a refresher on what was the problem of the reformer in the late medieval church. The main problem is anyone who's attempting to work against or reform the church or against the common practices and the excesses and abuses of the Catholic Church is going to end up finding themselves fighting against religious authority, because that's the only weapon the Catholic Church has left. It's not going to be able to stand on any sort of moral or theological grounds. And as they are, as reformers are working to reform either the practices of the church, or as Luther is going to start posing serious theological questions to the church, they're not going to really have a response. Not until we get to Trent are they going to start articulating a more theological or philosophical response to Protestantism. And so the reformer is going to find himself or herself, because there are women who are reformers during this time period, although they don't run into the same amount of problems typically as their male counterparts do. They're going to find themselves fighting against religious authority. And this is going to mean that the church is going to brand them a heretic on no basis other than, this is what the Pope says, this is what you say, they're different, the Pope is right, you're wrong, type of mentality. It's pretty heavy-handed. But it's all that the church has left, so the church really has a lack of weapons to defeat reformers. And this is going to lead to a problem with the church in different time periods, in different places. You're going to have people that are going to be saying the exact same thing or very similar things. One of them is going to be burned as a heretic. One of them is going to be made a saint by the Catholic Church. It really just depends on where you are and who the people are in authority directly over you. So the Spanish end up reforming their church in the 70 or 80 years before Luther comes around. And all the people that end up reforming the Catholic Church, saints, no problems with them. And that's one reason why, because the Catholic Church is kind of reformed in practice before the Reformation gets started, that's one reason why you will see virtually no Protestantism in Spain. In France, there's Protestantism. In England and every other country in Europe, even in Italy, there are lots of people that, at least beginning with Luther originally, are on his side and agreeing with him, but that's not the case in Spain. So really what you have the image of that I want you to get before we get talking about Luther is the church leading up to the Reformation is a rotten tree. It looks like it's fine on the outside. It's powerful. It looks strong. It looks monolithic. It looks like there's no problems with it. There are some reform issues, but the church has kind of been able to beat those off, seemingly. But really all that's waiting, because the church is rotten on the inside, is one person who's going to be able to have enough political backing to protect him, and the church will start coming apart at the seams. So that's what's going to happen with Luther. So we'll go on to the next slide here, and we'll talk about Erasmus. Now, Erasmus, there's a famous saying about Erasmus, is Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. So Erasmus is really going to get things started and get people thinking about this, and Luther's just going to come along and just take Erasmus's ideas and thoughts to their logical conclusion a lot of ways. And Erasmus is going to be upset by this. He will go on and say later that, you know, if I had known the problem I was going to cause by saying these things, I never would have said them in the first place. Because even though he and Luther for a long time, and we'll talk about where this break eventually happens, but they go along for a while, but then they end up splitting ways and actually becoming opponents. But Erasmus is the illegitimate child of a priest in the Netherlands. His parents both die, both his father and his mother obviously die, in a epidemic of the plague. He is left to a relative to take care of him with the money that his parents would have provided for this, and he is forced by this relative into a monastery to take vows. So he is forced into a monastery, and Erasmus is going to go from there. He's very, very bright. He's going to go on and get a very good education. It's going to be part of the new humanist education. I should probably tell you a little bit about this. This differs from scholarly or scholastic ideas, basically by the fact that the scholastics are posing kind of theological questions and looking at the medieval world and trying to take Aristotle and religion and kind of weld these two things together. This is not the goal of the humanists. The humanists are trying to return, in a lot of ways, to ancient Greek and ancient Roman ideas. So they are concerned not necessarily with abstract questions of reason and faith, but they're more concerned with rational thought. They're more concerned with how can I write so that it sounds good, different things like this. And Erasmus is going to be the greatest of the humanists, without doubt. So he's going to be helped in his work. He writes a number of works, the most famous of which we'll talk about in a second is going to be his New Testament. But he's going to be helped because during this time period that we're going to be talking about, there's an invention or a modification to an already existing invention that's going to revolutionize, probably be one of the most revolutionary things that's ever invented. It's going to be the printing press. So the printing press has been around for a number of years before this point. We can move to the next slide. Had been around. Here's a reconstruction of what many believe Gutenberg's printing press would have looked like. The printing press had been around for a while, but what had happened was you either had to cut out of wood or out of metal a solid sheet of what you wanted your page to look like, which obviously would have taken a long time. Gutenberg's innovation is going to be movable type so that he can take a page and take the word, the letters, individual letters out, and rearrange them over and over again as many times as he wants. And this is going to lead to a number of things, the most important of which is going to be just books are going to be readily available. Before this, a book would have been incredibly valuable, not just in the sense that there aren't a lot of them, and so they're valuable in the sense of their scarcity. It would have been valuable in the sense of their expense. A book would have cost about as much as a farm would have cost. So if you saw someone walking around with a book, it would have been, in a lot of ways, a status symbol and not just an educational device. Sorry. So what we have is Gutenberg is going to make knowledge more accessible because there's going to be more books where it would have taken a person, maybe could have copied a book in one book in about four or five months worth of time of writing it down by hand. Gutenberg's going to be able to make in a year about 200 or 300 books with his printing press. So it's much cheaper. And it's going to make, obviously, when you have more of something, it's going to make it cheaper. And it's going to increase the time that it takes for an idea to spread. So when we have someone like Huss or Wycliffe, who is in England or in Bohemia, two out-of-the-way places, and they have their ideas and they're writing their books, it takes a while for these ideas to spread. The only reason that Wycliffe's ideas end up spreading to Bohemia is because of the political connections that the two countries have at the time. His ideas really don't spread beyond that. But what we're going to see with Erasmus and with Luther is that their ideas really sort of explode and cover all of Europe without them really even necessarily intending that to be the case. So it's going to lead to a rapid spread of information. So these are all the things that the printing press is going to Now, the growth of learning is going to lead. We talked about humanism ad fontes, which is the Latin expression for kind of to the sources. So this is going to be a big idea that goes on in humanism too. What we're going to do is we're going to go back to the original sources as best we can and see what they say and not just rely on other information. And this is going to be key because Erasmus is going to do this. He's going to look at the Vulgate and say, well, I have a Vulgate translation of the Bible. It's in Latin. Why don't I go back and look at the Greek and see what that's going to look like? So he went and translated a Greek New Testament, and here's a picture of it. One side you have Greek, on the other side you would have had Latin. His Greek New Testament isn't the best as far as his translations aren't always the best, but it is an important step back towards sort, reading Greek and getting back to the sources. That's going to be very important. So, but besides this, Erasmus is a growing critic of the Catholic Church and a proponent of reform. And his ideas, because of the printing press and because of his skill at writing and because of his wit, are going to spread all over Northern Europe. And it's going to really lay the foundation for people to already, common people, average people that would have been able to read anyway, not necessarily your like average person on the street, but your average educated person, which there would have been fewer than there are today, but still more than there were during the time periods before this, would have been familiar with the issues and the problems that the church had. So when Luther comes along and begins writing and begins preaching, he's not going to be speaking into a void. He's going to be speaking to people who already know and understand and are familiar with some of the ideas that he's talking about. So this will get us to Luther. Now, Luther is the son of peasants. His father is a copper miner and becomes a relatively successful miner. He moves up. He's able to send his son to school. His wife's family, Luther's mother's family, at least have some history of education in it. It seems like at least one of her brothers might have gone to school or to university. And his father is very, very ambitious for his smart son. And he sends him to college. And from college, he graduates from college, and he's going to send him on to law school. And this is going to enable his family to rise, perhaps, out of the ranks of being a peasant into a better life. And Luther, because of his smartness and his intelligence, is going to be able to pull his family up with him. Kind of this idea of social mobility that's important and is going on at the time. His father has made himself successful, and now he's able to make his son more successful, and his son will be able to go on and help the family out. Go on. What ends up happening, however, though, as we are aware, hopefully you know, that on his way back to school, Luther is caught in a thunderstorm. In the midst of the thunderstorm, according to Luther anyway, he cries out to St. Anne, this would have been the mother of Mary, to protect him, and vows that he will become a monk if she protects him and he lives through the storm. And he does indeed survive the storm, and he enters the Augustinian house, a very strict house, and he turns his back on all the things that his father had for him, and he becomes a monk. Now, there's a lot of debate on how this happens with Luther, and a lot of especially reading back into Luther's mentality and his ideas and how he thought. So you get a lot of people like to psychoanalyze Luther. There's been a lot of works with this. And it really doesn't matter whether the psychoanalyzation of Luther is correct or not. What matters is this is what he thought for whatever reason he thought. Luther was consumed with the idea of a righteous and just God, and he felt himself that he was not righteous or just, nor could he do anything to make himself that. And so he took the route that was open to him. If you were worried about your salvation in the Middle Ages, what did you do? You went and became a monk because that was the best guarantee that you had of getting to heaven, of being saved. This was the way that you went about doing this. They were God's set apart people. He went and did this. This was what he would have done. And so he would have become a monk, and not only was he a monk, he became a member of a very strict house. And not only did he become a member of a strict house, but he imposed upon himself special fasts, special vigils, special prayers, added works. He confessed constantly to the annoyance of his confessor, so much that he confessed. He ruined his health with his fast by not eating, by his sleeping habits, denied himself blankets in the cold, did all this to try and make up for what he understood was his own sinful nature. So he'd even sit there and say, you know, did I forget something? Did I not do something enough? Did I do it for the wrong reason? He was consumed with doubt and guilt. And in spite of all of this now, he advanced rather rapidly in his house. His house sent him on to study at the University of Wittenberg. He got his master's in philosophy and his doctorate in philosophy there. And then they sent him on to teach at sent him on to become a new professor at Wittenberg. He didn't get his degree from there. And it was while he was teaching at Wittenberg, he's teaching through the Psalms and through Romans, that he has his kind of epiphany, where he understands for the first time that the righteous shall live by faith. And he's teaching through this in about 1513, 1515. And this is kind of where we start in a lot of his lecture notes on the Psalms and other things. This is where we start seeing these ideas develop with Luther. And so he begins having these ideas, but he's in an out-of-the-way place. He's at the University of Wittenberg. Wittenberg is off in Saxony, which is in far eastern Germany. He's at a small school, a relatively unimportant school. It's very new, just started by the Elector of Saxony. And if nothing else had happened, Luther probably would have remained there, having his ideas, teaching them to his students, and nothing else probably would have happened. But that's not what happens. There's a problem. So if we can move two slides ahead. The problem is that the Archbishop of Mons, or the newly appointed Archbishop of Mons, a guy by the name of Albrecht, who's from the House of Hohenzollern in Prussia, or Prussia or Brandenburg, is appointed to be the Archbishop of Mons. And to do this, he must pay the Pope a fantastic amount of money, because he's already the bishop of two other places, and he doesn't want to give either one of those two up. So he owes an amazing amount of money to the Pope, which he then borrows from the Fugger bankers of Germany. And then the Pope himself is in debt heavily to the Fuggers and to other people in Italy for the construction of the new Basilica of St. Peter's in Rome. So there's these two people with debts, and what are they going to do to alleviate their debt problem? They're going to have a big indulgent sale, and half of the money is going to go to Albrecht to pay back his debt to the Fuggers, and half of it is going to go to Leo. And they get a Dominican friar here by the name of Tetzel to sell the indulgence, and even though the indulgence is not sold in Wittenberg because the elector, Frederick the Wise, won't allow it to be sold there for a number of reasons, probably because he might have had some issues with it, but also because he didn't want anything to be taken away. He had collected an amazing amount of relics in his cathedral there in Wittenberg, and so he didn't want people to stop coming to his relics and looking at his relics and giving money for his to come and see the relics and touch the relics and receive whatever they thought that they got from the relics, instead of they would go over to Tetzel and buy the indulgence. So he outlawed the indulgence as his land, but it wasn't that far, and there were many people that would just travel the few miles away to get the indulgence. And so Luther hears about this, and he's upset by it, obviously. And so to combat the indulgence, what he does is he writes up his 95 theses, and he posts them on the door at Wittenberg, the church door at Wittenberg, on October the 31st. And most historians believe that this actually happened, that he actually did that. This wasn't just later fabricated, that he actually probably did post the actual theses on the door. And what this was, wasn't a challenge to the church anyway. What it's doing is he's just written a bunch of scholarly, like, ideas. I believe this, I believe this, I believe this, these type of things. And all he's doing is calling for a debate. I'm going to throw these questions out there. I think that this is right. I want to hear back from fellow professors, other people. What do you think? And that's all that he's calling for. And he feels a need to protect his parishioners, right? The people in his city, the people that in his church. And what's going to happen, though, is because of the new printing press, Luther's theses are going to spread all over Germany. He's going to go viral, and if you want to use that expression. And it's going to really get out of his hands. He's not going to be able to contain this. It's going to spread all over the place, and people are going to read this and respond to this. And Luther finds himself, this kind of obscure professor in an out-of-the-way university, finds himself at the center of a controversy. And the controversy is not going to go away. The archbishop basically tells Luther to shut up and mind his own business. The Pope seconds it and tells the archbishop to tell him that. But he's not going to do that. And so what we're going to end up having is a number of people who are going to come and try and debate with Luther. The most famous of these is going to be Johann Eck, who is a very skilled theologian, who is going to come, and before one of the princes of the area, he's going to challenge Luther to a debate. Luther's going to go. They're going to debate. And in the middle of this, Johann Eck is a very skilled debater, and Luther is not. And Luther is kind of backed into a corner, and what Eck does is he says that Luther is a Hussite. And Luther's response to that is, no, I'm not. A Huss was a heretic. I'm not a heretic. But Luther hadn't really read anything that Huss had written. So he goes back, he reads some of Huss's stuff, and he says, wait, this is exactly what I believe. And he comes back and he says, yes, I'm a Hussite. And in his notes, he says, not only am I a Hussite, but St. Paul is a Hussite. St. Augustine was a Hussite. All these people were Hussites. So it's not just me, and it's not just Huss, it's everyone. So what happens is, in defeating Luther, in challenging Luther to a debate over this relatively, everyone kind of knew that the indulgence really wasn't good, and they're just trying to get away with it to get their money. What they do in doing this, in defeating Luther and backing him into a corner, they force him to kind of see and draw a kind of theological line in the sand and start looking at it and saying, well, the Pope supports indulgences. This indulgence is wrong. Therefore, the Pope is wrong. And he's starting to be pushed into a theological direction that he probably would not have been pushed into as quickly or nearly as hard as he was by these confrontations that he's having with Eck and other people. So they're forcing him to kind of crystallize and understand his own theological position. Sorry about my voice. And now, after the debate, this is going to lead Luther to writing three works, which the printing press is going to, once again, spread all over Germany. So it's addressed to the Christian nobility of the German nation, the Babylonian captivity. Oops, that got cut off, didn't it? The Babylonian captivity of the church, and on the freedom of the Christian man. And he's going to write these and send these out. And these are not just theological tracts. These are polemic tracts. He's attacking the church. He's attacking the doctrines of the church, the ideas of the church. And what he's going to do with this is he's calling for the German people and the German nation, the nobility of the Germans, the German nation, to rise up and throw off the Pope and to throw off the errors that the church has and establish their own church in a lot of ways. And this is going to lead to Luther's excommunication. This is a picture of Luther burning the bull of excommunication, which he does outside of Wittenberg. They also burn a lot of other Catholic books. There's a big bonfire that they're having. And this is going to lead to the church alone is not going to be able to stop Luther. Luther is going to be, Luther is going to be protected by the Elector of Saxony. And I should probably stop and explain what the Elector is, but I'll do that in just a second. So the church alone is not going to be able to stop Luther. The church doesn't have any power. The church isn't going to be able to do it. The church is only able to excommunicate and actually execute heretics if the political authorities are willing to go along with that. And Frederick isn't. Now, we don't really understand right now if Frederick really bought into all of Luther's theological ideas. He was probably just happy that he had a professor who was becoming famous in his university. And he probably didn't want to see Luther taken to Rome and treated with this German hero that Luther is becoming, taken to Rome and treated poorly like Huss was treated, so he's going to protect him. That's what's going to go on. And this is going to cause a problem. Well, let's move on to the next slide here. And this is going to cause a problem for Charles V, who is the newly elected Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Charles V is the most powerful person in Europe since the time of Charlemagne. Not only is he the heir to the Habsburg throne, so the Duke of Austria, he's also the King of Spain, the first King of Spain. Before this, you had kings of Castile and Aragon and a number of other little principalities in Spain. But he's the first guy to unite all those together into one entity. He's also the Duke of Burgundy and the Lord of the Netherlands. So he controls, and the King of Naples. So, and all the Spanish Empire in the New World. He controls all of that too. He's extraordinarily powerful, extraordinarily wealthy. He's elected King of the Holy Roman Empire at 19. And what he has a problem. He's a devout Catholic, but he has a divided empire now. When he comes to the throne, he has a divided empire. Germany is turning into a pro-Lutheran kind of rebellious state. And even if he had wanted to back Germany and wanted to back Luther, what that would have done was alienate all the rest of his empire. So all of Spain, all of the Netherlands, all of Burgundy might have gone off. And so he has this problem of trying to hold two groups of divided people together. And he's going to try and do that by calling a council. And that's what he's going to do at the Diet of Worms, which is going to be an imperial diet where all the greatest of the German nobles are called together. It's going to be called by Charles in 1521. He's going to be 21 years old at the time. He's going to try and work this out. Maybe we can figure out a way to get this taken care of. He's going to grant Luther safe passage, not unlike Huss was granted safe passage to the Council of Constance. And don't think that escaped Luther. or the people around him for a minute. Luther is going to walk through Germany to Worms. It's on the other side of Germany, so it's in far western Germany. He's in eastern Germany. He's going to cross Germany. He's everywhere, through every town that he passes, crowds turn out. And the papal legate at the time, this is a very, very funny quote, the papal legate at the time in Germany that was there to kind of watch over this and see said that 9/10 of Germany shout Luther as their war cry. And the other 10th don't care anything about Luther, but they say, death to the Pope. So that's kind of the way that you can see how all of Germany has kind of risen in support. And Luther, this is really the height of Luther's German popularity, his height of his popularity period is right now. He goes to the Diet of Worms. He's ordered to recant. Basically what they do is they bring him into the room. Here's a picture of him. They have a big stack of all of his works there laid out in front of him. They ask him, are these your works? He says, yes. They say, do you recant? He says, no. And then they say, get out. Basically what he said, that's the way he described it. Now, it's going to be described a little bit differently by other people besides him. And what he's going to do is he has this very famous reply right here. Luther refuses to recant. And this is his reply. Since your majesty and your lordships require a simple answer, I will answer without horns and without teeth, unless I'm convinced by the testimony of the scriptures or by clear reason, for I do not trust either in the Pope or in councils alone, since it is well known that they have often erred and contradicted themselves. I am bound by the scriptures I have quoted, and my conscience is captive to the word of God. I cannot and will not recant anything, since it is neither safe nor right to go against conscience. May God help me. Amen. So this is Luther's reply to the emperor. And it's a reply that we would see people like Wycliffe having made. Scripture alone can convince me. I'm not going to listen to popes. I'm not going to listen to councils. While they might be helpful in some ways in helping me clarify difficult points of Scripture, I'm not going to trust them and make them equal to Scripture. And unless you can convince me by Scripture and by using Scripture to influence my reasoning, I'm not going to recant. He flees Worms. He's going to be outlawed. And basically what this outlaw is going to do is it means that everyone is forbidden from helping or aiding Luther. Anyone can kill Luther with no consequences whatsoever. He is an outlaw. Now, what's going to happen, though, is that this is going to, you might think, well, this shouldn't be hard. The most powerful man in the world here to capture one person and crush him. But Charles has a lot of popularity. Here's the quote that I talked about the popularity of Luther. So if he does kill and execute Luther, he could have a situation like happened when Huss was executed in Bohemia. The whole nation rises up against him. So he has that problem on his hand. He also has the structure of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Emperor is not a king in the way that we typically think of kings or emperors being. The Holy Roman Emperor is an elected monarch. There are, I believe, 8 electors in the Holy Roman Empire. And when the old Holy Roman Emperor dies, these electors, that's why he's called the Elector of Saxony, because he's one of the 8 guys who are going to go and elect the new emperor, get together and they elect the new emperor. There's going to be 7, that's right, there's 7. There's 3 clerical ones and 4 lay guys that elect him. So that's the way it works. So he doesn't have the power. He only has power if the people inside the Holy Roman Empire let him have the power, because the real power in the Holy Roman Empire, while he's very powerful, he's a very powerful German ruler, the Duke of Austria, he doesn't have all the power. There are people inside of Germany that are just as powerful a German ruler as he is. And then he has the problem of the Turks. Now, this is an interesting thing that goes on right at this time. At the time that Luther is writing and doing his thing in Germany, the greatest of the Turks' rulers, a guy by the name of Suleiman the Magnificent, is the caliph in Istanbul, or what would be Constantinople at the time, but Istanbul now, is the greatest ruler. And in this time period, the Turks are going to expand greatly, not just in the lower part of the Mediterranean. They're going to conquer Egypt and go over and conquer Tunis almost all the way to Spain again. But they're also going to go into the Balkans, and Hungary is going to fall. And they're going to besiege Vienna, which is where Austria is, obviously. So Charles has a problem with the Turks. They're invading his land. They're invading the kingdoms next to him. And he wants to crush them. But he can only do that if his German princes will go along with him. And if he's trying to kill Luther and crush Protestantism, they're not going to go along with him. And they're going to refuse. And he tries this. And they refuse to send him soldiers towards wars with the Turks. They said, until you allow us to practice our religion the way we want to, we're not sending you any soldiers. So he's kind of in a hard spot. So he's not going to be able to really persecute and try and stamp out this new kind of religious rebellion, the way that he might have if he was free from outside influences. So he's kind of hemmed in. He has problems, political problems and other things. It goes so far that the Ottoman Turks and the actual French who hate the Habsburgs, and because they're surrounded by the Holy Roman Empire and Spain, so they're obviously not going to be his friend. They go so far as to make an alliance. So you have Christians allying with Muslims against other Christians for political reasons. And that's going to go on. France is going to be very, very flip-floppy in how they deal with this because of their dislike of the Habsburgs. They're going to ally with Protestants with no problem against Catholics. You know, the French are just whatever serves our political purposes. So we'll move on to the next one now. This is going to be the Wartburg exile. So on his way back from Worms, back to Wittenberg, Luther is going to be kidnapped. He's going to be kidnapped, not by people that are trying to kill him, but by people trying to protect him, by the Elector of Saxony. He's going to kidnap him. He's going to send him off into the wilds of central Germany to this castle here. And Luther calls this his Patmos. He's exiled. He's away for a year, just about. He's going to be stuck in Wartburg. And he's going to, during this time, he's really going to struggle with what he's done. He's caused this humongous kind of rebellion and revolution inside of Germany. And he really struggles with depression during this time. Did I do the right thing? Did I act correctly? But eventually that's going to wear off. And this is going to be a great period of literary activity for Luther. You can go to the next slide. Great period of literary activity. He's going to write writings on the confession, on doing away with monastic vows, on changing the mass. He's also going to write back to Wittenberg and try and direct the events that are going on there. We'll talk about that very briefly. And most importantly, he's going to translate the New Testament into German. And not only, there have been other German translations of the New Testament before this, but Luther's is particularly good. And it's going to not only be going to be a great blessing to the German people as far as bringing the gospel into their own language, but it's going to transform the German language. It's going to be kind of in a lot of ways like Shakespeare or the King James version of the Bible is for English. It's going to be that for German. It's going to change the way people speak and the way they think about speaking and writing in German. So it's going to be very important. Now, the problem of the Reformation, and Luther's going to run into this, and we need to talk about this now, is change is hard to control once it's been started. It's like pushing a boulder downhill. You know it needs to go downhill, and you're going to push it, and you think you know where it's going to go, but once it starts, you don't really know. The other problem is, and we'll talk about this over and over again from now on, because change brings out the crazies. It just does. Anytime that you start changing things up, all the crazy people start coming out of the woodwork. And we're going to see this over and over again. This is what happens in the Second Great Awakening. Change brings out the crazies. You got John Smith and all these guys, Mormons and all kinds of other crazy people that come out. Once we start changing things and kind of letting this boulder loose, we don't have any control over where it goes. And that's going to happen in Wittenberg. The crazies are going to start coming out. And they're going to start really changing things in a way that Luther doesn't want. Luther is the guy who has started this. He's the leader of this, but he's away. And while he's away, right, things are going to happen that he's not going to be able to control. So we can move to the next slide. The Radical Reformation. Now, conservative things have been happening. People like Melanchthon, Luther's friend in Wittenberg, had started serving communion in both kinds. But then his other associate, a guy by the name of Karlstadt, begins. This is a woodcutting of him here. They start destroying the churches, so they would go inside churches and destroy the altars and pull down the images. They would stand outside churches where Mass was being said and mock it. Karlstadt's going to start preaching dressed as a layman. He's going to start simplifying the Mass. He's going to get married. They're going to threaten priests with violence. You're not going to go along with us? All right, well, we'll see what happens type of stuff. And destruction of images. And the church structure is going to be reformed. And this means that they're going to take the money that had been going to monasteries and to the church itself, and it's going to go to a lay committee in Wittenberg that's then going to give that money out as they see fit. So it's going to radically restructure the church. And then you have these guys from Zwickau that come along that are prophets, and they start prophesying all this stuff. And the big problem with them is that they say that their prophecy is equal to Scripture. What I say, the revelations that I have from God, they're the same as Scripture. So once again, the crazies are coming out. And Luther is going to have to return. So Luther leaves his exile. He returns. He preaches in the church and kind of calms everything down. And this is going to really be the beginning of Luther the conservative. A lot of times we think of Luther as being a very radical person. But a lot of what Luther is going to do after kind of setting the boulder rolling is trying to pull it back as much as he can and try and direct it where he wants it to go. And Luther is going to be a very conservative voice in the midst of all that's going on. Karlstadt is going to be banished. He's going to be in favor of a slow reform. And he's going to differ a lot from people like Zwingli, as we'll see in a minute, in that his view is that it's okay. We can keep everything the way that it is as long as the Bible doesn't tell us not to do it or doesn't tell us specifically something else to do. So Luther's going to be allow vestments. The host is still going to be raised in the service for a long time. A lot. It's going to be very, very Catholic. All that Luther wants is to cut out the bad pieces and keep everything else. And a lot of other people are like, let's just burn the whole thing and start over. So that's kind of the difference in Luther and the radicals. So let's move on to the next one. Now, at the same time, Luther's writing is going to give him another problem. Not only is he going to have a problem in Wittenberg, but he's going to have a problem in what's going to be called the Peasants' War, or probably maybe this is what you would hear it called. A more accurate translation or idea might be the Farmers' War, because these aren't going to be like poor, homeless peasants. These are going to be fairly well-off farmers who have social, political, and economic grievances with the structure of Germany at the time. And there had been other peasant rebellions before this. This one just happens to be particularly large. And what they're going to take is, this is not going to be necessarily religiously motivated. These aren't religious radicals that are running around. They are socially, economically, and politically motivated. But what's happened is Luther has challenged authority successfully and has written about liberty and freedom and all these words that they are going to then take and say, all right, let's go kill some nobles because they're causing us problems. And that's what you're going to have. So you have about 300,000 peasants by the time that this thing gets heated up, wandering around the country, killing nobles, destroying things. And Luther is going to be taken aback that his writing could be used this way. And he's going to react rather violently. He's not known all the time for his judgment and when he's speaking. So this is what he says. He writes a tract called Against the Murdering, Thieving Hordes of Peasants. And he says, therefore, let everyone who can smite, slay, and stab secretly or openly, remembering that nothing can be more poisonous, harmful, or devilish than a rebel. And these are times so extraordinarily that a prince can win heaven more easily by bloodshed than by prayer. Now, we have to understand, it's very easy for us to kind of cast stones at Luther and say, that probably wasn't the best idea. We have to understand, Luther's in a very awkward position. The only reason that Luther and his reforms are at all being able to do anything is because he's being protected by nobles. And if he's seen as any way as backing peasants who are killing nobles, his reform will be shut down quite quickly. So he has to come out and give something emphatic that shows he supports. And he does support this. He doesn't. He is beyond anything else. Luther might be a rebel, but he doesn't favor rebellion. He favors reform. He's just trying to weed out, once again, the problems. He doesn't want to burn the whole thing down and start all over. So he does this. And the nobles, just as easily as the peasants, can take the things that Luther writes the wrong way. And so they round up the peasants, who are quickly dispatched when they run into artillery that God doesn't stop the cannonballs from plowing into their ranks and killing them. They're rounded up, and about 100,000 of them, that's probably the best estimate, about 100,000 of them are killed. And that crushes the peasants' rebellion. And at the same time that this is going on, Luther's personal life, he gets married. He's 41. Catherine von Bora is 26. It seems to be a fairly happy marriage. There are struggles, as in all marriages. They're poor, oftentimes had financial difficulties. But Luther is very fond of his wife, even though he would take around the beer that Catherine von Bora would brew. She had a brewery in the basement of the monastery where they lived. He'd take around the beer to all the different places that he would go and give it to his friends and like, here's, look at the beer that my wife makes. It's awesome type of stuff. You can see Luther doing this. And then they would have, because they lived in this huge old monastery, they'd have people that boarded with them and lived with them. And what ended up happening when they'd have a big table where everyone would sit down and eat, and Luther would talk at the table and everything. And eventually, some of his students and some of his friends would begin taking notes while he was talking to catch all the stuff. And this, again, eventually after his death got turned into a book, which is a very good book. Probably the most, one of the more accessible things that you, if you wanted to read Luther, that you could read. It's called Table Talk. And it's going to be just these things that Luther would talk about around the table. And you get a real sense of who he was as a person, the good and the bad things. So that's what's going on. Now, about 10 minutes, so good. We're going to have the small Caldic Wars are going to break out after this. And what's going to end up happening is all the Protestants in Germany are going to get together and form a political and military alliance called the Small Caldic League. And before this happening, actually at the Dyer of Speyer, this is where they tell the emperor, no, we're not going to help you unless you allow us to think. This is where they get the word Protestants from, is because these Lutheran nobles protested against the way that the emperor was doing things. So they're going to form the Small Caldic League. And what this is going to be is a political union of Protestant principalities and cities and different things like that. And eventually, once Charles is able to free himself from a lot of his political connections, he's going to wage a war with the Small Caldic League, called the Small Caldic Wars, and he's going to defeat them. So we can go to the next slide. And this is eventually going to lead to the Peace of Augsburg, which was going to be important. And what ends up happening is after he defeats the Protestant, he tries to find a way. He realizes probably that he's not going to be able to stamp out Protestantism, but he tries to find some middle ground that we can exist on between trying to weld Germany back into one church by kind of taking some things from Protestantism, some things from Catholicism, getting them together. And Melanchthon is going to be important in trying to do this, but it's not going to work. The rebellion has gone on too long. The revolt has gone on too long. Protestantism has moved too far away from Catholicism at this point. It's going to lead to a further rebellion. The French are going to come in on the side of the Protestants, and Charles V is going to be forced to flee, and he's going to have to make this peace, which leads to the famous Latin saying, cuius regio, eius religio, which means whose region, his religion. So whoever's region it is, he can choose the religion. So if you're the prince of the region, you can choose whatever religion you want to be within Luther or Lutheranism or Catholicism. And after the Peace of Augsburg, Charles will abdicate the throne. He suffers severely from gout in his later life. And he's also going to abdicate all of his thrones, and he's going to spend the rest of his next 3 years before he dies living in a monastery. So this is kind of the end, the small Caldic Wars and the Augsburg interim and all the things that he tried to do to weld Germany back together was kind of his last push trying to unify all of his realms and fix all the problems, and it just didn't work. So I'm not going to be able to fix this. Now, at the same time that Luther is doing his thing in Germany, Zwingli begins to do the same thing in Switzerland. Zwingli is a humanist. It's going to be very, very different, because this is going to influence how Zwingli and how Luther differ. But he is going to be influenced by Luther's writings, despite his claims that he's not. And what he's going to usher in is a new and more radical Reformation. We talked about Luther wanting to kind of hold on to the things that could be saved from Catholicism. Zwingli's going to be content to let the whole thing burn to the ground. Well, let's move on to the next one. And this is going to be the beginning of the Swiss Reformation. And these are the different views. So Zwingli's view is, if the Bible doesn't tell me to do it, I don't do it. And I don't do anything else. So the Bible doesn't mention using instruments, so no instruments. The Bible doesn't mention singing hymns, no hymns. A lot of things like that. The Bible doesn't mention images or paintings or stained glass. We're getting rid of all of it. So if the Bible doesn't expressly tell me to do it, I don't do it. And Luther's is, if the Bible doesn't tell me not to do it, I can do it. So it's a very different view of what the Reformation is going to be like. Now, the nature of Switzerland is going to impact this as well. The nature of Switzerland, unlike Germany, where Luther really had to deal with nobles and lords who are kind of directing, kind of helping him direct how this was going to go and what he was going to be able to do and what he's not going to be able to do. Switzerland is made up of free cantons and cities, these big areas like city states, and they're ruled democratically, pretty much. And they're going to be divided eventually into half Protestant and half Catholic. Switzerland will be half Protestant, half Catholic. And they are really going to push Zwingli forward because it's going to be the popular element of the people that Luther really had to try and restrain the people and the nobles and try and keep them working together. Zwingli's not going to have that pull of the nobles, that conservative pull. And so the people are going to be pushing him to be more and more radical, or more, do more and more reforming that Luther would not have done. So this is kind of what's going on. Now, this is going to eventually lead to the Marburg Colloquy. And this is going to be called by Philip of Hessen, a German nobleman who, Switzerland's part of Germany at this time. It's more free than a lot of other parts of Germany, but it's still part of Germany. And what he's going to try and do, he says, we need to get all the Protestant leaders together because there are a lot of different little varieties at this point that are popping up. So you have Luther, you have Zwingli, you're going to have people from Strasbourg in what will be now France come down. And they're going to all get together and try and hammer out their differences and make one uniform version of Protestant Christianity. And that's going to be important because what Philip of Hessen wants is a political union, too, with all these Protestants together to kind of fight against and guard against the Catholics. And there can be no political union, he believes, if there's not religious uniformity. And everyone there, especially Luther and Zwingli, are going to agree on 14 out of the 15 points. A lot of agreement. But it's going to eventually fail because of the one point where they disagree on, and that is going to be on the Eucharist or the Lord's Supper, and particularly on the presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper. So Zwingli is going to move. He's very rational. He's going to move away from the mysterious element of the actual or real presence of Christ in the elements. And he's going to move more towards it's just a symbol. And Luther says no. While he denies transubstantiation, he's going to affirm that there is a real presence of Christ in the bread and wine. And he will actually, when they get together, what he does is when Luther gets there, he writes it on the table and says, I'm not moving. And he says, no amount of conversing or logic is going to convince me that this is my body, is going to make me believe that this means, that is means this is a symbol of my body or a sign of my body. So they do not get along. Luther can be very, very ugly sometimes, and especially towards Zwingli. He doesn't like Zwingli a whole lot. And so this is not going to work. Luther and Zwingli are not going to get along, and this whole idea of trying to create some sort of uniform belief is not going to work. Now, Zwingli is going to be killed in the political fighting that goes on between the Protestant cantons in Switzerland and the Catholic cantons in Switzerland. He's going to be killed, and his place is going to be taken over by Bullinger. And eventually the Swiss Reformation is going to be taken over by Calvin, and that's where we'll pick up next time, right on time. Any questions about Luther or Zwingli or any of the things that we covered? I know it's a lot, and we're just trying to get you a big kind of overview of what's happening. Yeah, Bill.
What time period did the Huguenots appear?
The Huguenots, okay. The question was, what time did the Huguenots appear? The Huguenots are going to be appearing around this same time period. So in France, the same time period that all this is going on, the Huguenots, Protestantism is going to be spreading to France as well. It'll spread to Italy. There'll be a number of Protestant people that will end up moving to Germany once they figure out that Italy's not a safe place for them to be.
Do they come out of the German Protestant?
Yeah, they're going to be influenced.
Or does it arise separately but inspired by?
I think it's inspired by. I don't think you're going to find any more than just they're reading about it and people are agreeing and getting together. And that's the influence of the printing press. So they're going to be able to quickly spread these ideas all over Europe, and they're going to spread to places like France where this is going to rise. And I'm trying to, you have three or four different streams that you have going on, and we're trying to pick up the guys that lead the three streams. So, yeah, France is going to be picked up next time when we talk about Calvin a little bit. Yeah.
You said something about Spain having been reformed somewhat.
Mm-hmm. No. Very different, actually. That's a good question. So I talked about Spain being reformed. Spain is reformed in practice, but not in not philosophically or theologically reformed. So a lot of the excesses of the Catholic Church are going to be taken out. So the simony, the pluralism, all that kind of stuff. Spanish church is going to be very, very rigorously run and governed by the Spanish monarchy. And the Spanish monarchy is going to have a very tight control over what goes on in that. And since they are reformed, like practice-wise, a lot of the Protestants' complaints against the Catholic Church that are practice-oriented, like your wealth and all this other stuff, the Catholic Church doesn't have to deal with any of that because it's already been taken care of. It's really an evidence in a lot of ways of what could have happened if the Catholic Church had chosen to reform itself ahead of time and not allow this to take place. The Catholic Church probably would have been strong enough to at least use a lot of Luther's ideas or just not be influenced by them at all if it wanted to be, if it chose that route. But that's not obviously in God's plan. Yeah. Yes, so there are going to be later attempts, and actually, 2012, about 10 years ago, Lutherans and Catholics got together and said, oh, we actually believe the same thing now. So they got back together, and all their anathemas and all the things that they had done against, they basically said, we're trying to say the same thing, we're just using different words, and we got over that. And there are going to be other times where Protestants are going to get together. None of it's going to work, though, because what's going to end up happening is Protestantism is going to continue to, that stone rolling down the hill is just going to keep on picking up speed the faster it goes, and you're going to get more and more separations that are going to start taking place. So this is really the one best shot that they had, and even though there's going to be later people that try and get together, Melanchthon's going to be an important factor in that, it's not really going to work. Because by this point, you're going to have Anabaptists and, you know, then you have Reformed Swiss guys with Calvin and stuff like that. So it just starts fragmenting. Yeah.
I have a conception of Zwingli as kind of a more violent guy than Luther, like
involved in wars. Oh, the wars thing? Yeah, I don't think Zwingli, it's really interesting. Zwingli is being more violent than Luther. Zwingli actually is a big opponent of the Swiss mercenary system, which is one of the ways that Switzerland kind of kept their economy going. The Swiss were the best fighters in all of Europe at this time. And everyone came. There's a reason why that if you go to the Vatican today, the people who guard the Vatican still are Swiss males between, I think it's 18 and 19 and 25, and they're from the Catholic cantons of Switzerland still. And because at the time period, they were the absolute best fighters in all of Europe. And what they did is they leased themselves out to the highest bidders. They go over here and fight. They go over here and fight. And each canton did that. And so Zwingli was a big opponent of that and didn't like the fighting. He was just kind of caught up. Zurich, where he was attacked by the Catholic cantons, and like a surprise raid. And he went out to help defend the city. And they were defeated and he was killed. So he is probably a little, Luther's pretty volatile too. They're both pretty antagonistic and, people. So that can't be anyway. Any other questions? All right, then we'll dismiss. Thank you, guys.